who could play cool lead parts, we got Dave Casillas. Dave was talented at guitar, but he was far more talented at getting wasted. When he wasn't forgetting the songs or falling off the stage, he'd spend 5 minutes between songs tuning his guitar, with the amp on, and somehow ended up more out of tune than when he started. And he'd show up to practice or shows without pieces of his gear. "Where's your distortion pedal, Dave?" "I sold it for an 8-ball of Coke." An 8-ball, mind you, that Dave would do all by himself. For the uninitiated, doing an 8-ball by yourself is like one person eating an extra-large pizza. It's not unthinkable, but it's meant to be shared. When Eric Melvin is the most solid guitar player in your band, you're in trouble. But Dave was fun to be around, so it took us a while to accept how bad he was on stage. Just as it took us a while to notice, Eric Sandin had become a heroin addict. I would guess that at least a third of the Santa Barbara punk scene was on heroin at the time. In that little bubble, it was somehow a socially acceptable drug. Strangely, heroin seemed to have the opposite effect on Smelly than it did on most people. Instead of mellowing him out, it made him more energetic. He would go on to record S&M Airlines, Ribbed, The Longest Line, and White Trash, Two Heaps and a Bean as a junkie, and his drumming was always spot on. The only thing that tipped us off to his problem was when dope sickness hit him on the road, and even that we didn't notice right away. We did 2 long tours with Dave across the country and back, and Eric was sick just hours after we left L.A. We brushed it off as a flu because after a few days, the drugs would be out of his system and he'd be back to normal. Dave was a much bigger issue. We were at a house party after a show in Rhode Island when suddenly there was screaming and commotion. Dave was caught, red-handed, taking the wallet out of some girl's purse. We were supposed to stay there that night, but instead we were run out of town. We weren't able to get another show in Rhode Island for 6 years. When we got home from that tour, we realized Dave had amassed quite a record collection along the way. It turned out he'd been stealing from every house we stayed in. Records, money, medication. Rhode Island wasn't the only place where we were suddenly blacklisted. During our first tour with Dave, we also had the bright idea of trying to supplement our income by selling acid on the road. We bought 2 sheets of acid for $50 apiece and sold half to a skinhead we knew named Dave Rosebro and his very large Mexican friend, who had a huge slash over his eye like Omar from The Wire. The next day, we were at the NoFX house, and we got an answering machine message. "You're gonna sell us bunk acid? You guys are fucking dead." It felt like someone had popped a balloon in my chest. We got them on the phone and explained that we didn't know the acid was bad, and we'd refund their money, and hey, we'll even give you a distortion box just to make it up to you. Thankfully, they accepted the offer, and no blood was spilled. Except Dave Rosebro's, when he later shot himself in the stomach with a rifle, just because he wanted to know what it felt like. He survived. We still see him around sometimes. Nice guy. Now we were out the money we paid for the 2 useless sheets of paper, plus a distortion box. We sold the rest of the fake acid on the road to try and break even. So, in the end, Dave wasn't the only one ripping people off. In hindsight, we should have had Eric test the acid because, even though heroin and alcohol were his drugs of choice, he would do whatever drugs were the easiest to find. And acid was always easy to find. Most people don't realize that acid makes your fart smell worse than usual. Eric would destroy the van with his flatulence. It was an indescribable odor that was more of an evil entity than a smell. Combine that with his foot odor, and that's where Eric got the nickname that would stick with him for the rest of his days, Smelly. We were a van full of foul-smelling, drug-abusing thieves playing barely listenable music and selling fake drugs across America. It was the worst of times, it was the worster of times, and overall, it was starting to wear a little thin.
Chapter 33, Smelly. It was somewhere on the road to a show in Ashland, Oregon, when I realized Dave Casillas might become a problem. We had left from San Francisco early in the morning, and he was still drunk from the night before. But he started pounding 40s the moment we got in the van. We stopped for a lunch at Burger King, and he couldn't manage to get the food in his mouth. We had to put his arms around our shoulders in order to walk him to and from the van. Mike and Melvin thought it was hilarious, but I was thinking, we have a show tonight, and he's not stopping. What the fuck are we going to do? I voiced my concerns, and Dave said, "Don't worry, I'll sober up before the show." And then he cracked open another 40. Dave could barely stand up that night, let alone play guitar. This would prove to be a common occurrence on the rest of the summer's tour. Most people who drink at his level would simply pass out, but it seemed like Dave's body shut down before his brain did. He would be conscious, but his legs would be jello. It was embarrassing when he would fall off the stage, but it was often even more embarrassing when he would remain on stage and attempt to play. We brought our friend Juan on tour as a roadie, and when we arrived in Portland, he got into an argument with Dave about his shitty playing. It got heated, and Juan slugged Dave in the face. Dave grabbed his guitar and tried to swing it at Juan, but I intervened. I broke up the fight. Dave was yelling, "You're going home, motherfucker!" Juan was only guilty of articulating what the rest of us were feeling, but we couldn't keep him on the road with Dave, so we bought him a bus ticket home. I was bummed that we had to let him go. It wasn't Juan's fault that Dave's face always seemed to be asking for a punch. Hell, I punched him the night before. We were shooting coke after the Ashland show, and Dave claimed he had exhausted the supply, but I knew he still had some on him. I punched him in the face and laid him out. It was never too difficult to knock him off his feet. He drank so much, he did most of the work for you. A few weeks before the tour, we had a show booked in Ventura with RKL, and Dave was supposed to meet us for a ride to the gig. He was off, shooting coke at some chick's house, so we were waiting for him for over 2 hours, with no clue when or if he might ever show up. This was obviously in pre-cell phone days. There was no way to contact him or figure out where he was. We just sat and waited and stewed in our anger. As fucked up on booze and drugs as I was at the time, I took the band and our show seriously, especially this particular show. RKL were our musical heroes. We worked hard to imitate their sound, and I had dedicated myself to learn how to thump my kick pedal as quickly as their drummer Bomber did. When Dave finally strolled up with that big, stupid smile on his face like he hadn't done anything wrong, I said, "Fucker," and popped him. After a couple weeks of drunkenly stumbling off stages across the country, we were staying at a house in North Carolina nestled next to this beautiful, quiet lake. We had a couple days off, so we were drinking and swimming and enjoying the sunshine. There was a pier that led out from the shore into the lake, and our host, Bo from Subculture, was very clear. "Don't dive to the right." He explained that the lake had been created by chopping down a bunch of trees in the valley and then flooding it with water, and there was a big stump hidden under the surface of the water to the right of the pier. We'd be fine if we jumped to the left, but he kept reminding us, "Don't dive to the right." Sure enough, later that afternoon, I was sitting near the shore when I heard a loud smack. Dave dove to the fucking right. I didn't see him jump, but I turned and watched him emerge from the water, stumbling and deformed like a swamp creature. His eyes were now farther apart, his nose was pushed to the side, and his skin had become an alien shade of gray. His face was split from the middle of his forehead, down the bridge of his nose, along the bottom of his eye, to the middle of his cheek. We got him to the hospital, and they stuck over 100 stitches in him overnight. When he got out, he looked like fucking Frankenstein. I made some tactless joke like, "What's up, Scarface?" to lighten the mood. Everyone just stared at me, totally offended. Thankfully, he didn't lose his eye or any teeth. He was just grotesquely disfigured. So they let him out of the hospital, and we continued on with our tour. The plan was to leave our van on the East Coast and fly to Holland to begin our first European tour. Dave had never been on a plane before. He drank so much wine to calm his nerves that the stewardess had to cut him off. One of the guys told one of the stewardesses it was Dave's first flight, so they made an announcement over the PA system. "Ladies and gentlemen, we have someone with us today who's never been on an airplane before. Sitting in seat 16F, we'd like to welcome our new flyer, Dave Casillas." Everyone turned around to see this slobbering, drunk punk rocker who looked like the victim of a recent axe murder with 100 oozing stitches. I don't know who's more frightened, Dave or every single other passenger on the plane. After one of our shows in Europe, Dave and I were drinking tequila, and at 3 a.m., we had the bright idea to wake up the other guys, yelling, "Woo! It's party time!" Our tour manager, Dolph, palmed Dave's still-healing face and shoved him to the ground. Dave's face was a symbol of all that frustrated us about our band. Even though Dave was the only one who couldn't stay on his feet, we were all drunks. We couldn't play well, our songs sucked, we had no sense of responsibility. We were spinning our wheels trying to get somewhere with this ugly, scarred, stitched-together sound. Punching Dave was symbolically taking out our frustrations about ourselves, as much as it was literally taking out our frustrations about Dave. We were our own worst enemy, and somewhere along that European tour, Mike started to crack.
Chapter 34. Dave? Dave's still not here, man. Those guys have vivid fucking imaginations. There's no way I was too drunk to eat a cheeseburger. And when I went to score some coke before that RKL show, I was gone 30 minutes, tops. Not that I was keeping a close eye on my watch or anything. And Sandin didn't punch me. He slapped me. I would have slapped him back, but his crazy friend Raymond was standing right behind him at the time, and I wasn't that stupid. And I definitely have no memory of selling my distortion pedal for drugs. Then again, I do remember a guy coming up to me at one of our stops in Oregon, handing me a pipe and offering me a teaser. I had no idea what a teaser was, but it turned out to be a hit of crack. They call it a teaser because, sure enough, later that day, I was begging Mike to front me some money to go buy some more. I don't remember selling my distortion pedal to that dealer, but maybe I did. Okay, yeah, that one is possible. I tried coke for the first time at a house party in Santa Barbara, and, as any coke addict will attest, it was a blast. We couldn't afford that shit down in Oxnard, so I rarely bought any for myself, but I would shoot it or snort it whenever it was available. And in Santa Barbara in the 80s, coke was very often available. Booze and drugs seemed to be the perfect cure for my shyness and my crippling stage fright. And once we left for a tour, every day was a party, and there was no authority figure around to say stop. Alcoholism was an inevitability. I don't deny that I fell off stages. I admit I regularly screwed up the songs. And okay, fine, I guess I could have been too drunk to eat that cheeseburger. But I just have no memory of it either way. I do remember tripping on acid one time in Ashland, though. Everyone was inside the house, and I was cowering in the van, totally freaked out. Sandin came to check on me, and when he opened the van door, I looked up and saw a fucking gorilla. I refused to leave the van and begged the gorilla to let me go to sleep. That Oregon monkey acid is bad news, man. And they say Juan punched me in the face. No way. He pushed me, and I swung my guitar at him. Then they pulled us apart, and I hid out in the van because I knew the guy could fight. The next day, I made the band choose him or me, and they sent him home. But no one landed any punches. I mean, that one's on video. You can see it during the Johnny Appleseed section of the 10 Years of Fucking Up DVD. Okay, I just rewatched it, and I guess he really did clock me good. That son of a bitch. There are a lot of videos from those days. I haven't seen them in years. But there's one from a night in Philadelphia featuring me interviewing people at the after-show house party. And you can see the light outside getting brighter as the sun comes up. I'm tickling Melvin and Sandin's feet as they dangle from the van while they try to sleep. And the next thing you know, Mike is telling me it's time to leave for the next town. The nights drifted into days and back into nights, blurred by the constant flow of cheap beer. I don't know how Mike was able to put up with all my shit. All I can say is he's an extremely patient person. He was at a payphone one night trying to get directions to the next gig or whatever, and I was drunk running around outside the van like a little kid at recess. For some reason, there was a small brown paper bag sitting near the phone booth that happened to be filled with soot. Why someone left a bag of soot near a phone booth, I'll never know. Why I dumped the entire bag over Mike's head is just as much of a mystery. He looked like Elmer Fudd after Bugs had plugged up his gun barrel. He tried to grab the bag and throw it back at me, but he was playful and not pissed. If the roles were reversed, I would have been pissed. Soot doesn't come off that easy. For all my antics, I wasn't the thief they described either. I stole only one record, a rare pressing of an X-Ray Specs album that Mike had mentioned was worth a great deal of money. Other than that, the only thing I stole was an old Stalag 13 sticker that some kid had at his house. And a carton of cigarettes, which I guess was pretty dumb, since I was the only smoker in the band, and the theft was easily traced back to me. But that was it. I definitely did not go through anyone's purse in Rhode Island. At least not that I remember. I mean, I guess I can sometimes be a thief when I'm drunk enough, so who knows? I also don't remember anyone saying anything about don't dive to the right. If they did say it, I wasn't around to hear it. Or maybe I just wasn't paying attention. I was drinking in the house with Bo from Subculture and saw everyone swimming out in the lake, so I ran out of the house and took off my shirt and shoes and jogged to the dock. Why I chose to dive right instead of straight or left is yet another mystery, but I dove in head first. Strangely, I didn't feel anything when my face hit the stump. I was just stunned and trying to figure out what had gone wrong. Somebody said, "Dude, you hit the stump." I touched my hand to my face and suddenly my hand was covered in blood. "Oh my God, what are you talking about, a stump?" It was the first I'd heard of it. The pain didn't set in till I was already at the hospital, but when it did, it was intense. It was followed shortly by a deep, unshakable depression, as if I needed two more reasons to get blasted every day.
Chapter 35, Mike. A German booking agent named Dolph set up a European tour for the adolescents in the summer of 1988, and the adolescents had to cancel, so Dolph needed an American band, any American band, to fill the dates. We had previously bugged Dolph to book us in Europe, but he never returned our calls. When he was completely out of options and facing financial loss, no effects was better than nothing. We left our van in Baltimore and flew to the Netherlands. Dolph had booked our first show in Rotterdam, opening for a semi-popular industrial band called The X. We played in front of 300 or so blank-faced Dutch goths. And after the show, Dolph, with that classic German bluntness, said, "I thought you guys were a lot better. I remember seeing you at Gilman Street and thought you were good, but I must have been very drunk." Dave Casillas, who was currently drunk, got right in his face and said, "Fuck you, I think we're pretty good." Dolph palmed Dave's freshly stitched face and shoved him across the room, and we had to break them up. Only 22 more shows to go. After our first show, we had 4 days off in Amsterdam, where we stayed at a squat called Van Hall. It was full of Italians who were there trying to avoid their country's mandatory military service. We drank and wandered the streets and ate pasta every night. Smelly only brought $5 on that trip, which he spent on a single beer when we first arrived. As is tradition in NoFX, however, things immediately went downhill. We were touring with a German band called Drowning Roses. So between the four of them, the four of us, our roadie Jerry and Dolph, there were 10 of us stuffed into a standard van, and we had no trailer. So all our gear and luggage rode inside with us. You couldn't put your feet down if you were sitting in back because the guitars and amps were in the way. So you had to sit in upright fetal position. The drive from Rome to Munich was 22 hours. I probably could have overlooked the discomfort if we had played any shows that went well, but Europeans didn't seem to enjoy us any more than Americans did. We were universally disliked. After a few shows, we insisted that Drowning Roses perform as the headliner over us because it was clear they were better. In Frankfurt, a feminist group protested the show because we had one song called On the Rag. They turned the PA off after two songs and threw firecrackers and big German beer bottles at us. One of the bottles nearly hit Melvin, so I picked it up and hurled it back into the crowd. Some huge dude jumped on stage to attack me, but Melvin shoved him into the drums, and Smelly clobbered him with the bottle. Dolph got on the microphone and somehow calmed everyone down while we escaped backstage. It finally started to sink in that maybe we're not that good a band. It's one thing to brush off a bad crowd reaction or two, but once you've played 100 cities across half a dozen countries, maybe the crowd isn't the problem. Why was I bothering with the fights and the thrown bottles and the general embarrassment of being a member of NoFX? We sucked so bad that we'd become a danger to ourselves. Operation Ivy put their Yelling in My Ear 7-inch out around that time, and I fucking loved it. I was vaguely acquainted with the guitarist Lint, so I planned to return to the States and somehow convince him to let me be their roadie. I would rather roadie for a good band than sing in a terrible one. It wasn't the most solid plan, but it was all I had. When the tour was over, we returned to Amsterdam to fly home. We emptied our bags and guitars out of the van, which was going to be picked up that night by Fugazi to use on their own first European tour. Of course, Ian McKay from Fugazi, Minor Threat, was famous for coining the term straight edge and proudly declaring that he didn't use drugs or alcohol. Knowing that he'd be using our van for the next few weeks, we, in a blizzard of immaturity, intoxication, exhaustion, and frustration, poured a six-pack worth of beer all over the inside of the van. It was petty revenge against an innocent target. It wasn't really about saying fuck you to Fugazi, it was just us saying fuck you to the tour and to everything that had been fucking us up for the past year or two. The funny thing is, we actually really liked Fugazi. This was in their early days, when they were at their best. We opened for them that night, and I was thrilled to meet Ian backstage. "Hi, I'm Ian." I was barely holding back my giggles, thinking, "Of course you're Ian." He was super friendly and cool, and the whole band was. They even let us use some of the gear on stage, so the guilt from our little prank settled in a little earlier than it might have otherwise. I've spoken with Ian in the years since, but he never mentioned this sticky, stinky van we left for them. Our apologies, guys. That night, we also met some members from another American band called the Yeastie Girls. They asked me if I'd heard the new Bad Religion album, Suffer. They dropped the cassette into the stereo and basically changed my life over the course of the ensuing 26 minutes and 14 seconds. It was the best thing I'd ever heard. It was a style of melodic punk rock that walked the perfect line between pop and hardcore. I listened to the tape 10 times that night. I thought that if I tried, maybe I could come close to writing something almost as good. Maybe NoFX deserved another shot. I abandoned my plan to be Operation Ivy's roadie. I had a new plan. Stop sucking.
Chapter 36, Smelly. Europe was like landing on an alien planet to me. I was baffled by the stringent political correctness. And I cracked up listening to people make all these strange sounds and using them as language. I snagged loose cobblestones to bring back to my friends as souvenirs, as if they were moon rocks. We went to the Vatican, and I had never seen anything like that in my life. I don't consider myself a spiritual guy, but I was awestruck by its size and significance. Just like that first station wagon tour of the Northeast, coming home from Europe felt like we had accomplished something real as a band. It didn't matter that no one liked us, or that we ended up in physical fights with both our crowds and our tour manager. I considered the tour a success, just by virtue of existing. We weren't looking at the band as a potential career by any stretch, but we had boldly gone where I had never for a moment expected us to go. Not that that experience matured me in the least. I poured beer all over Fugazi's van interior, along with everyone else, and I definitely earned the runner-up prize for most childish drunken behavior next to Dave. The night Dave and I woke everyone up at 3 a.m., Mike was livid. "You fuckers! I don't need this shit! I'm going to fucking college! I have a fucking life. You're fucking embarrassing me. I'll quit this band right now, and it won't make any difference. Fuck you. You owe everybody a fucking apology." Thankfully, something turned him around by the time we got back to the States, and Mike decided to stick with NoFX. And these days, he's the one keeping everyone up. But I was not done testing his patience by a long shot.
Chapter 37, Melvin. We started calling Dave Sal because it was the name of Al Pacino's partner in Dog Day Afternoon. There's a scene in the movie where Pacino asks, "Is there any special country you want to go to?" Sal thinks for a moment and replies, "Wyoming." Pacino patiently explains that Wyoming is not a country. Dave had never really traveled, so he was geographically clueless. When we landed in Europe, he asked, "Did we fly over an ocean to get here?" He caught shit for that one for the brief remainder of his time in the band. Despite the setbacks and the thrown bottles, our first European tour was a beautiful moment in time. There are few things more magnificent than Amsterdam in mid-September. The canals, the bicycles, the architecture. We weren't jaded world travelers yet. We were wide-eyed 20-somethings whose only responsibilities were to drink beer and play punk rock music. Back home, we couldn't help but doubt whether we were making the right decisions by not doing more to prepare for our futures. But for those first few days in Europe, we felt like all of our bad decisions were finally being rewarded. It didn't even get me down too much when milky goo started dripping out of my dick after gulping down too much drinkable yogurt. Yeah, I know what you're thinking, but the doctor at the Amsterdam clinic assured me, in his best broken English, that it wasn't gonorrhea. NoFX survived the long drives and the drunk fights between Dave and Dolph by adhering to our policy of just rolling with it. The drummer from Drowning Roses didn't have the same philosophy. He let the road get to him, and he was always angry about something. I remember him being mad because he suspected one of us of using a stage towel. "This towel smells like dick." We burst out laughing, We honestly hadn't touched his towel. His rage, especially when delivered via his German accent, was just hilarious to us.
I know this smell. This smells like dick.
Why do you know the smell of dick so well? The harder we laughed, the madder he got. He actually quit the tour halfway through, and Smelly pulled double duty, filling in for Drowning Roses for the rest of the shows. I can't say for sure if it was a purely altruistic move or if he had some residual guilt for wiping his dick on that dude's towel. Some bands might have had the exact same experiences and come home feeling like failures. No one showed up, we lost money, our guitarist was a mess, and the guy who booked us would probably never work with us again. On paper, we were a disaster. But we had a record out. We had been to Europe, and we were making friends, if not fans. We started from such a low place that by comparison, we were on top of the world. We would do better next time.
Chapter 38, Mike. I worked for a short time at McDonald's in high school. I also put in time at a couple of women's shoe stores. My dad hooked me up and delivered pills for a local pharmacy. I delivered to the homes of Sammy Davis Jr. and Johnny Carson, but the only celebrity who ever answered her own door was Elizabeth Montgomery, and she was one of the few who bothered to tip. I wish I could tell you what they were all taking, but all the packages were coded. I saved up enough money for my crappy bass rig, the tour van, and the recording of our first two 7-inches. I had enough left over to fund our first actual LP, Liberal Animation. It cost $675 total. We recorded and mixed the whole thing in 3 straight 16-hour days with Brett Gurewitz, the founder of Epitaph Records. He offered to put it out on his label, but I wanted NoFX to have its own label. That's what Bad Religion did, that's what Minor Threat did, that's what we were going to do. Not only was I the only one in the band with any money, but I had fallen into a leadership role by default, probably because I was the least fucked up. I didn't do drugs at the time. I didn't drink nearly as heavily as the other guys, so I was the one handling all the stuff that required brain power. I booked the tours, I dealt with the promoters, I loaded the van at the end of the night. So, I was the one who started the NoFX label, Colossal Wassail. See, everyone would be wasted after the shows, so it always fell onto me to play Tetris with their gear and fit it into the back of the van. My bandmates would praise my van loading skills. Mike is the best at loading the van! And I would ride that ego boost. Yeah, I'm the best! I realize now that they totally Tom Sawyered me into loading the van while they went off to pick up girls. The first pressing of Liberal Animation was 2,000 copies. We sold about 1,200 over the course of our tours with Dave Casillas and our first trip to Europe, and lost another 100 or so when some Mexican gangsters grabbed a full box of them at a show in L.A. I still have a few dozen sitting around somewhere. I should eBay them. Years later, when we started to see some success, I sold the album to Epitaph Records for about $50,000, which I'm sure they've recouped by now. So overall, it was a successful experiment in DIY record releasing. Most importantly, it established our relationship with Brett Gurewitz. After hearing Suffer, I knew we had to work with him again in order to somehow copy that sound that Bad Religion had created. First, though, we had to fire our guitarist.
Chapter 39. Okay, Dave's still not here, man. Europe should have been the best time of my life. I should have been excited and happy for my first ever trip out of the country, but I couldn't get into it. I don't know if it was a medication for my face, or an overdue chemical shift in my brain, or simply road fatigue. But by the time I got on that plane, I just didn't give a fuck anymore. I couldn't have any fun or change my bad mood, no matter how hard I tried. I drank to deal with the depression. I drank to get myself on stage. I drank to fuel myself through the partying. And I drank because it was Europe, and there was beer everywhere. As we toured back through the States, my depression never improved. In New Orleans, we went into one of those tourist places that make cheesy karaoke videos, and we filmed a music video for our song, Shut Up Already. Everyone in the video was hamming it up and mugging for the camera. I faded into the background and moped through the whole thing. Our friend and roadie DJ is in the video, looking more like a band member than me. Sure, there were still fun moments, like watching our roadie Jerry smear Bengay on Sandin's balls while he was passed out. But I kept getting severe headaches. Again, it's hard to pinpoint whether it was the booze, the depression, or my still-unhealed face. But halfway home, I started saying, I'm done with this shit, after every show, and meaning it. Like every other band I'd been in, NoFX finally hit its expiration date. We played a Victoria's Welcome Home show in Santa Barbara after the tour, and a few days later I got a call from Mike telling me that everyone agreed I shouldn't be in the band anymore. It wasn't a 3-against-1 decision. It was unanimous. A few years later, Mike called me up to invite me to a sold-out NoFX show at the country club in Reseda. The place held 1,000 people. When I was on tour with them, we were happy to draw 25. I immediately thought, damn, I should have stuck it out. But I never would have been able to hack it. I didn't need extravagance or creature comforts. I can live in a fucking shack if it came down to it. But I wasn't built for the road life. I love playing music, but I also love sleeping in my own bed. I took the stage once more with NoFX at their 325th anniversary shows in 2009. Sandin will tell you I was drunk at the San Diego show, and I couldn't stay on my feet. But I only fell over at the very end when I lost my balance after jumping into the monitors. But I rolled back onto my feet and still managed to nail the leads. You'd think they'd give me a little credit. But you know how it is with those guys. Vivid fucking imaginations.
Chapter 40, Mike. Pam Shriver is a former tennis player who won a gold medal at the 1988 Seoul Olympics. While she was in Korea representing our nation, we snuck into the backyard of her mansion with some Baltimore punks and had a midnight pool party. Before our first European tour, we ended up stuck in Baltimore for a few days after one of our shows was canceled. We bought a keg of beer and partied with the locals the whole time. They showed us around the city and took great care of us, and we bonded with some of them enough to keep in touch with them to this day. One Baltimore punk in particular served as an exceptional tour guide and party planner. His name was DJ, and he looked like a slightly smaller version of Smelly. They both had crazy dreadlocks and a troublemaking smile, and they both loved to get blitzed. His sense of humor and attitude completely meshed with ours. He kept an eye on our van while we were away in Europe, and when we returned to the States, he hopped in the van and we drove him out to California with us. And that's where he stayed. I don't think remaining in Baltimore would have sent his life down a healthy, productive path, but moving to LA with NoFX definitely accomplished the opposite.
Chapter 41, Smelly. DJ was only 16 when we met him, but he was so goofy and hilarious that he fit in with all the 20-something punks he was living with in Baltimore, and he fit in even better with NoFX. He pitched in as a roadie, and everyone in the band loved him. But DJ and I grew closer to each other than anyone else, which is why I feel bad for kind of ruining his life. I guess in the end, I can't blame myself entirely for DJ's willingness to shoot heroin, but I was the one who first stuck in the needle. The first person I initiated into junkiedom was my friend Ming. In the extra sections of the NoFX Backstage Passport DVD, Ming gives us a quick history lesson about Tiananmen Square. He was one of the older punk kids who went with me to my first show. We went to MacArthur Park one night to go to an underground club called The Scream, but it was closed for some reason. Two chicks pulled up, also looking for the club, so we chatted them up for a while. One of them seemed a little rough around the edges, so I asked if they knew where I could score some dope. They told me about a place nearby, so Ming gave me a ride to the Mexican neighborhood to get the drugs, and then a ride to the black neighborhood to get outfits, needles, and other associated junkie tools. We drove up some side street, and I shot up what turned out to be some really shitty Mexican junk. Ming was always open to new experiences, so when I asked him if he wanted to try it, he said yes. I cooked up a shot and went to eject it into the top of his hand, but for some reason his blood coagulated in the needle and plugged it up. The standard procedure in such cases is to heat up the needle in order to liquefy the blood and clear the passage. Once the syringe was unclogged, I shot him up, but I didn't wipe the black residue from the flame off the needle. So Ming was left with a small, circular tattoo about the size of a BB pellet to commemorate his first fix. It's still there. I cringe whenever I see it, because I think about how I was partially responsible for his journey from being an aspiring artist going to college to being a substitute teacher who was shooting up between classes. Eventually, I helped him get clean, but the drug took a lot from him during those years in between. DJ was the only other junkie I ever mentored. Ming and I were shooting up in Ming's garage, and DJ wanted to be included. He put on a front like he had done heroin before, but just forgot how to do it and needed a refresher course. He had just arrived in California. He was probably as eager to be accepted as I always was. I couldn't see it at the time, though. So I stuck in the needle and brought him down into the pit with me. My friend Johnny Sixpack started a gang called Dog Patch Winos. Well, they weren't really a gang. They were more like a group of alcoholic misfits who liked to get as wasted as possible and wear matching jackets. I had been inducted before the tour, and DJ fit in with them immediately when he moved to California. They provided a modest network of people up and down the coast who could offer drugs and places to sleep. DJ and I became junkie hobos, couch surfing with friends and bouncing between crash pads in LA and San Francisco. DJ was my junkie apprentice. Despite the fascination with heroin in our pop culture and the vast amounts of books and movies about the subject, there's so much more you learn when you actually start shooting up. I apprenticed under Raymond, but I earned my master's degree in junkie studies on my own. And now it was time to share my knowledge. I could teach a UCLA extension course in that shit. Lesson 1. Radar. If you're not a junkie, you may not realize that heroin is being bought, sold, and shot all around you. The need for junk gives you a sixth sense. When you walk or drive through a neighborhood where heroin is available, you know. You can spot a dealer from a mile away, and you can predict when he's going to make his handoff down to the second. You can look at two nearly identical gutter punks and tell which one is holding. Other junkies can outwardly appear as Mexican gangsters or high-powered businessmen in perfectly pressed suits, but either way, you see through the disguise. And they see through yours, too. You'll walk down the same street you've walked down 1,000 times, but now that you are a junkie, some random sketchy dude will walk up to you and say, "Hey man, I'm holding. You want some?" It's a subconscious subculture. And later, when you're trying desperately to get clean, you'll still be acutely aware of every dealer, every user, and every speck of heroin within reach for the rest of your life. Lesson 2. Transport. So now you know where the dealers are, and you want to buy some drugs. You think it's going to be sexy and cool. You'll shake hands with somebody and exchange a palmed wad of cash for a discreet little baggie, using a sleight-of-hand move that would make Penn and Teller jealous. Well, yes, you hand over the cash very deftly, but they don't hand you a baggie. They pull a small, tied-off balloon out of their mouth, and you quickly take it and stick it inside your own cheek. The concept is that if the cops stop either you or the dealer, you can quickly swallow the balloon and retrieve it later. Sure, it's gross, and you're swapping spit with some random scumbags, but this is probably the least disgusting element of your future as a heroin addict, so you should try to get over it quickly. Much more disgusting is what happens when you do have to swallow your stash. I bought 4 balloons, such was my tolerance at the time, from a dealer in Hollywood while hanging out with this girl I was dating. She didn't know that I made the deal or that my cheeks were stuffed with heroin. We were just drunk and driving back to my mom's house where I'd been crashing while my folks were away. I got pulled over. I was too drunk to be driving, and I was ordered out of the car to perform a field sobriety test. As I was doing my best to walk a straight line and touch my fingers to my nose, I gulped down all 4 balloons. And then I passed the fucking test. The girl I was with was probably confused about why I was so angry that I had just avoided a jail sentence. I excused myself to the bathroom when we arrived to my mom's house and stuck my fingers down my throat in order to throw up the balloons. But I couldn't get myself to puke, so I had to wait and let nature take its course. The next day, I went through my mom's cabinets and pulled out a spaghetti strainer. I told you the spit swapping wouldn't seem so bad after a while. I put the strainer in the toilet and took a balloon-speckled dump. I went into the backyard, and I used the hose to melt away the poo while panning for gold. After a full day of waiting to get high, watching my shit dissolve into that strainer was equivalent to being a kid on Christmas morning, running into the living room and seeing all those gleaming presents under the tree. After I shot up, I washed off the strainer and put it back in the cabinet. It's probably still there. After all, when was the last time you replaced your spaghetti strainer? Lesson 3. Funding. My circle of junkie friends had a racket going where we would steal high-end art books and sell them to some scummy guy we knew for 20% of the cover price. Snag a $200 book on architecture, make $40 cash. Enough to get high for the day. You'd walk into a store with a coat draped over your arm, shop around and pile up the books that might be worth something, and then, on your way out, cover the pile with your coat and slip out the door. You could usually hit the same store several times, until one day you'd walk in, and they'd tell you to get the fuck out because they finally got wise. DJ and I were hitting a store in the valley that we'd hit before. I had a car at the time, so I was the getaway driver and he was the thief. I parked at a gas station with easy access to an alley that would allow us a covert escape. While I was waiting for DJ, I got out to take a leak. I locked the door because there was probably $1,000 worth of stolen books in the back. As I returned to the car after my pee break, I saw two big-ass dudes chasing DJ. They tackled him and started manhandling him. I grabbed my car's door handle. I had locked the keys inside. The big dudes looked up at me while they roughed up DJ and could tell from our dreadlocks and matching dog patch wino jackets that we were probably in cahoots. I ran down the alley, hid for a couple hours, and watched the cops take DJ away. When the heat died down, I borrowed a coat hanger from a nearby dry cleaner and retrieved my car. DJ ended up in county jail for 30 days. I kept stealing books and never got busted. I guess the real lesson is that you shouldn't steal, but theft generally goes with the junkie territory. So you should at least try not to lock your keys in the car when you're the goddamn getaway driver. Lesson 4. Overdosing. My friend Jimmy Dredd and I were shooting up in an apartment in San Francisco. I did my dope first, went to the bathroom, and came back to find Jimmy unconscious and not breathing. Everyone else in the apartment was too high to notice, so I dragged Jimmy to the shower, sprayed him with cold water. I guess current medical advice says you're not supposed to do that because you could send the person into shock. But that's what I was taught to do by other junkies. I assume you're not supposed to dump ice on a person's balls either. But I did that as well in my frantic attempt to wake him up. He still wasn't breathing, so I called 911. Part of the junkie code is that if someone ODs, you call the ambulance, wait until you hear the sirens, and then split. That way, you're with them if they need you, but you also don't get busted. I could have gotten nailed for manslaughter if Jimmy died, since I was the one who caught the dope he was using. Best case scenario, I was getting arrested for possession. So I shouted at him and slapped him around until I heard the sirens and then bailed. Jimmy spent a few days in the hospital, but he lived. Although he's dead now. I ended up with a pretty bad rep in the San Francisco music scene, though, because the rumors were that I left him for dead. No one gave me credit for calling 911, much less icing down his balls. You start to grow numb to the news of friends ODing because you can't possibly keep up emotionally. Susan, one of my roommates from San Francisco, OD'd on Christmas morning and died in a Taco Bell bathroom. As soon as one of our other roommates found out, she grabbed all of Susan's stuff, her clothes, her bike, everything, and sold it all to buy dope. It sounds like a cold and ghoulish thing to do, but the truth is, Susan probably would have done the same thing if it had been one of us. Lesson 5. Social stigma. If you've started shooting heroin in the first place, you're probably the type of person who already feels out of step with society. But heroin addiction will take you to an even lonelier place. It's not a party drug. It's something you do in dark alleys and bathroom stalls and places where you know no one is watching. Sure, you'll spend time with your straight friends, but you'll spend more and more time with other junkies, or in pursuit of dope, or in pursuit of money to buy dope. It's a full-time job. But even if you manage your time effectively enough to hang out with your friends will stop wanting to hang out with you. I moved into a basement of a party house in San Francisco, and a German girl named Susie, who I had met on our first European tour, flew out and moved in with me. She OD'd the first night. I found her on the floor of the bathroom, and, just like Jimmy, threw her in the shower, smacked her around. Again, you're not supposed to throw an overdose victim in the shower, but you're not supposed to let him stay asleep. If I hadn't been there to wake her up, she most likely would have died. After clearing that little hurdle, we just lived in our basement world of fucking and shooting up and shooting up and fucking. Mike and Aaron moved into that house a month or so after I did and were so grossed out by our behavior that a couple weeks later, Susie and I came home and found all of our shit on the porch and on the sidewalk. Bringing my dog patch wino friends over and having Johnny Sixpack and Bob Lush spray paint the kitchen walls probably didn't make me an ideal roommate either. Without a place to live, Susie and I went our separate ways. She tried to go straight but couldn't. She hanged herself 6 months later. I've always carried a lot of guilt over Susie's death, and it has only intensified in the years since I've become a parent. even though I wasn't directly responsible for her habit or her living situation or her suicide, I've always been haunted by the idea that Susie's mom put her on a plane to see me and never saw her daughter again. Lesson 6. Dope sickness. It's the fucking worst. You're nauseous, you're agitated, you shiver and you sweat. Your muscles ache, especially the ones in your legs for some reason, and you can't sleep because your brain tortures you, whispering devilishly over and over again, "If you just had a little bit of dope, you'd feel fine." The first time I was dope sick was when I was living in Santa Barbara. I went home to visit my family for Christmas and didn't realize I was already an addict. I just thought I had the flu, and I didn't connect the dots when my flu went away the minute I got back to Santa Barbara and got some junk into my system. I finally put two and two together on the next NoFX tour. I rarely scored on the road, so when I was hit with the same flu symptoms, I slowly figured out the connection between sickness and the distance from home. I rode in the back of the van, shivering, sweating, cramping, sleepless. DJ came out with us again, and I'm sure he was hurting just as bad. In the absence of heroin, the only way we could relax was by drinking to excess and then beyond. Our natural predilection for mischief, coupled with our unbridled drinking and drug usage, gave birth to our new nickname, the Moron Brothers.
Chapter 42, Melvin. When I played the first NoFX 7-inch for my mom, I could tell she was struggling to think of something complimentary to say about it. "Wow, I can really hear the guitar." She may as well have patted me on the head and hung a record cover on the fridge, but it was sweet that she cared enough to patronize me. As a fellow musician, I think she wanted to encourage my artistic side, and she never really got a chance to travel when she was younger. So when we started touring, she was happy for me to have the opportunity to go all over the States and Europe, even if it was in the back of a used dry cleaning van. But as the years went by, she also saw me living in her house, broke, with no real commitment to school or any plan beyond continuing to make music she didn't understand. She wasn't off base at all for suggesting I join the army. She was just trying to help. I decided to stick with the band for a little while longer and see where it took me. Then maybe I could go back and study psychology again, or maybe I'll look into architecture instead. Or maybe I'll just keep living the Hollywood life of going to bars and shows every night and occasionally hitting the road with my buddies. I was in my 20s. Did I really need a plan? But meanwhile, I couldn't just lie around and be useless. My uncle was vice president at Fred Siegel, and one night when he was over, he offered me a job in the warehouse at their flagship Melrose Avenue store. I received an inventory of shipments, put price tags on $2,000 pairs of pants, took out the trash, stacked boxes, and did anything else the salespeople didn't want to do. I've always been a little OCD, so my stacks were straight, my work was done neatly, and I cleaned incessantly. I was a good employee. I probably could have worked my way up to warehouse manager if I'd stuck with it. One of my coworkers was a tall rocker dude named Skip, who started a New York Dolls-ish band called New Improved God. They weren't part of the hardcore punk scene, but Skip and I got along, and I started hanging out with his friends. One of those friends was a long-haired metal fan named Steve Kidweiler, and we had two loves in common, pot and guitar. Steve and I were from different musical worlds, but we bonded quickly. He knew all the technical stuff about guitar that I'd never bothered to learn, like diminished this and augmented that, and when I finally saw him jam one night, I found that all that theory came packaged with undeniable skill and passion. I played Steve the Liberal Animation album, and he offered me the same type of strained compliments my parents did. Punk wasn't his scene, but we needed a second guitarist, so I invited him to join NoFX. Luckily for us, he didn't have any better options.
Chapter 43, Steve, channeled by Osama McDonald. I was 10 years old when my mom took my brother and me to see Kiss at the Omaha Civic Auditorium during their Love Gun tour. I still have the ticket, and it remains unripped. While we were waiting outside before the show, the crowd was getting restless and shouting, "Open the fucking doors!" And then boom! Crash! Everyone funneled through the broken gates and we were caught in the mob like sand running through an hourglass. My mom tried to mask her fear. "Stay close to me." Security couldn't stop the tidal wave of people. Everyone pushed their way to the front, and ultimately my mom and I ended up with better seats than she had paid for. I got a photo with my Kodak 110 of a thumb-sized Gene Simmons blowing fire. At the end of a miraculous night of makeup and drum solos and fake blood, my mom and I found a note on my mom's car that said my brother, who had wandered off with his friends, had gotten sick and called my dad to pick him up. We came home to find him in bed, resting up after a bout of reportedly ferocious vomiting. I relayed the awesomeness of the concert to him, and just as his jealousy was peaking, I heard my mom on the phone in the other room. "Yes, Mr. Simmons's room, please." She had correctly deduced that Kiss would be staying in one of two hotels in the Omaha area. She tried the Holiday Inn first and got lucky when she called the Hilton second. The next thing I knew, my brother was on the phone with Gene Simmons. Gene extended his sympathies about my brother's illness and chatted with him for a minute, and then the phone was passed to me.
"So, did you come to the show tonight?"
"Yeah."
"Uh-huh. Did you like it?"
"Yeah."
"You don't sound very excited."
"Oh, no, totally, man." My mom saw my deer-in-the-headlights look, gracefully took the phone, and thanked Gene for his time. The next day, my mom went to the hotel's front desk to pick up a gift Gene had left for my brother, a personalized autograph on a piece of Hilton stationery. Woo! That's when I decided I wanted to be a rock and roller when I grew up. We were a military family, so we bounced around a lot when I was a kid, but Omaha was where I saw Kiss, where I started playing drums and guitar, and where I bought my first record album, Olivia Newton-John, If You Love Me, Let Me Know. I bought it mostly for the innocent yet sexy shag-haired beauty on the cover, but I was always open-minded about music, digging on everything from Nugent to Merle Haggard to Fifth Dimension to Chicago. When my family moved to Merced, California in the early 80s, I fell into a group of guys who introduced me to Ozzy and Maiden and early Motley Crue. Some of the local skater kids played me the classic punk stuff, Sex Pistols, Dead Kennedys, Circle Jerks, and it was all right, but none of them had the guitar solos of Randy Rhoads or the drumming of Tommy Lee. After short stints in a few other bands, I started playing guitar in my very own rock group, Tantrum. We put on a couple of well-attended DIY shows at a rented VFW hall and the Merced Fairgrounds, and we sunk all our profits into recording a demo in a converted guesthouse studio produced by a guy who normally recorded religious bands. We nicknamed him Kamikaze Ken in the liner notes to cover for the conservative suburbanite glasses-wearing reality. We sent it out and got a "We're Very Interested" letter from Time Coast, an indie label that released Rat's first LP, I believe produced by the engineer who did Nervous Breakdown by Black Flag, but we never heard from them or any other labels again after that. And that summer, at a keg party in the woods, our drummer and bassist got in a fight over something that has since been completely forgotten about, and Tantrum ended, ironically, over the very thing it was named for. I did a year and a half at Merced Junior College, and then discovered an unaccredited, for-profit music school in Los Angeles called the Guitar Institute of Technology, currently known as Musicians Institute. GIT, GIT, was a perfect excuse to get me out of Merced and maybe get another band going. My parents had some money saved up, and they figured that with credentials I could always get a gig as a guitar teacher, so they covered my tuition and wished me well. My drummer friend Kenny and I found a junior one-bedroom apartment on Franklin and Whitley in the heart of Hollywood. Not too long after we moved in, we were crossing the street on our block when a car came to a screeching halt next to us, quickly followed and boxed in by two LAPD cruisers. The cop shouted, "Get on the ground!" So we hit the deck and kept our noses to the asphalt until they apprehended their suspect. Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Merced anymore. Another day, I came home to find our front door ajar, Kenny on the couch with a look of pure fear on his face, and a guy who looked like a roided-out version of Billy Idol yelling something about how Kenny had stolen his rock. I assume he meant drugs, but he could have also meant a hunk of granite for all the sense he was making. Kenny hadn't stolen shit. The dude had just walked into an apartment as Kenny was about to leave for the day. I somehow reasoned with the guy. If we flipped the couch cushions and still couldn't find his rock, he would have to go. He agreed to the terms, but when we found nothing, he demanded pieces of Kenny's drum kit as restitution. I slowly folded up one of the cymbal stands in a way that allowed me to wield it as a potential weapon. "Now it's time for you to go." Thankfully, he listened. The upside of living in L.A. in the late 80s was bearing witness to the restless music scene. Metal, punk, and alternative were blurring together. I would watch Guns N' Roses play at the Whiskey on the West Side and Pygmy Love Circus play at the Scream downtown. And in between, I would hang out at the Rainbow, hoping to catch a glimpse of Lemmy or Slash on their way to the VIP room. The downside of living in L.A. was everything else. My time at GIT was trying, to say the least. You had guys from Bangladesh and Tibet who absolutely ripped on guitar, but who were socially defunct, so there was little hope of forming a band with them. You had egotistical instructors trying to stamp out an assembly line of jazz fusion players. And you had homeless street punks razzing you on Hollywood Boulevard as you made your way to and from class with your binder and gig bag. It's hard to convey how unwanted you are as a guitarist in Los Angeles. Mosquitoes in Florida get a better reception from the public and have better job prospects. After a year, the illusion that I was going to jump in a band and get signed to a major label had been thoroughly shattered. I was frustrated with school to the point of giving up, and I was commuting to and from Beverly Hills to work at a gas station for $4.75 an hour to pay my bills. After a customer was robbed at gunpoint, I decided to close full serve every night after 8 p.m. When the owner found out, I rejoined the ranks of the Hollywood unemployed. My friend Kent had also migrated south from Merced and had been playing guitar in a band called New Improved God, or NIG for short. They blended a throwback CBGB's punk sound with an alternative rock sensibility. The singer, Todd Godzilla, had half his head shaved and wore skin-tight jeans with a white dinner jacket on stage. And Skip, their bassist, was a 6'2" version of Sid Vicious with long black hair down to his nipples. Skip and I immediately hit it off. One evening, I dropped by his apartment to ritualistically make a case of Budweiser disappear, and his roommate was at the kitchen table rolling the first dreadlocks into the hair of a man named Eric Melvin. Eric and I exchanged reptilian head nods, and Skip mentioned that Eric was in a band called NOFX that had just returned from a tour across the U.S. and Europe. I was impressed. I had never heard of them, but they had a record out and were touring Europe. They were living the dream! I hung out with Eric Melvin a few times and got along well with him. I mean, who doesn't? And one night at Skip's, Eric mentioned they were kicking their guitarist out of the band for being too drunk. Skip was like a wingman trying to facilitate a hookup. "Hey, dude, why don't you join NOFX? Eric, why don't you get Steve here to play?" It put Eric and me in an awkward enough position that we agreed to meet up and listen to liberal animation together. As we sat in my apartment and listened to the album, I thought, how can I let this guy down easy? It was different from anything I had ever heard, I can say that much. The drumming caught my attention, but mostly I didn't feel like it was the right band for me, nor was I the right guy for their band. But really, I had nothing else going for me at the time, and there was a sense of urgency pushing me as I watched every Sunset Strip metal band go from the clubs to the major labels. Everyone was scratching lottery tickets and coming up a winner. I needed to start scratching a ticket of my own. The reality, of course, is that's not how it works. It's foolish to expect mainstream musical success in the first place, let alone expect it to happen overnight. But Hollywood was and always will be full of fools, and I was one of them. Melvin and I had a few beers and worked on some songs. I struggled with their unorthodox strum patterns. Theirs was not a technique covered in the GIT curriculum. But I guess I faked it well enough because the next thing I knew I was in Melvin's Mustang heading up the 2 freeway to a guy named Ming's house where NoFX had a practice space set up in his tool shed. I heard later they didn't like my long hair, my puffy-tongued high tops, or my Randy Rhodes Kramer copy guitar. But there was no open animosity or any impoliteness at the audition. Eric Sandin's sickly, gaunt frame didn't register at the time as a symptom of drug addiction. I assumed he was on a top ramen diet, just like every other musician I knew. Fat Mike was one of the craziest bass players I had ever seen and one of the worst singers I had ever heard. We went through 2 songs, and they gave me a copy of the demos they had cut for what would eventually be S&M Airlines. I guess I was in?
Chapter 44, Mike. As the main songwriter and chief van loader for NoFX, it fell upon me to fire Dave Casillas. Smelly and Melvin and I all agreed after Europe that he had to go. He didn't seem to care. We were NoFX in 1988. Who gives a shit? We still liked the idea of a guitarist who could play rad leads and fill out our sound, and my new Suffer-inspired songs needed that dimension to them, so we started auditioning people. There was a guy from a Las Vegas band called Poor White Trash. He came out to California to audition for us, and he was perfect. He played great and was fun to hang out with, so we said, "You're in." He rolled up his sleeve to reveal a tattoo he had just gotten of the NoFX logo. He was that confident in the outcome of his tryout. And then he disappeared. We tried to contact him for 2 months before we gave up. We didn't hear from him again for more than